I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Today on Intersection, we pick up with part two of our interview with former Central Intelligence Agency Director Porter Goss. In part one, Goss spoke about how the CIA changed after 9/11 and the nature of intelligence threats facing the U.S. In part two, Goss picks up on recent activities in North Korea and watching emerging threats in Africa. Plus, the former CIA director reflects on his time in local Florida politics and founding a newspaper in the southwestern part of the state. That's ahead on Intersection. My guest Porter Goss served as the director of the Central Intelligence Agency from 2004 to 2006 under President George W. Bush. Before that, Goss served in Congress and local Southwest Florida politics. He also served as a CIA case officer in the 1960s and 70s. In part one of our conversation, we covered how the purpose of the CIA changed after 9/11. In part two, we pick up with how Goss views the regime in North Korea.
If what is going on in North Korea is very important, because I want to know what they're going to do in the dynasty, in the Kim Il-sung dynasty, the next leader is going to do. They do have some mischief material over there, as you've seen recently. They've tried to export some to Syria. They're constantly in the business of weapon sales and creating trouble around the world. It's how they get attention, how they keep themselves in power and are able to get away with the stuff they get away with. They're in a time warp as a country. They have a dynasty that survives strictly on brute force and legend. The legendary Korean Peninsula identity has to do with the great leader who comes down from the sky and down to Mount Paektu and becomes a tiger and a bear and then turns into the great leader and so forth. It's not that the guy's a thug who was trained in Russia years ago and came back and created this myth and has perpetuated it through abuse and tyranny and atrocity and handed it down to his family. Successfully so far, because nobody's felt it's worthwhile to go in there and fix the problem. We tried very hard, and the Chinese took the wrong side, and we had a very long, painful, bloody time with them, and now it's still...
You're talking about the Korean War?
The Korean War, sure. And it's still out there. It's unresolved. You can still go up the 38th parallel, and you could watch the North Koreans come over and try and intimidate you.
I want to ask you also about Africa and the CIA's role over there. You know, we see that there are terrorist group offshoots in places like Somalia with al-Shabaab, and then there's the Islamist sect Boko Haram in Nigeria. And, of course, recently there's also been political shakeups in North Africa, places like Libya, Tunisia, Egypt. I wonder, is the CIA mostly focused on those developing African locales where there's the potential for Islamic extremism and terrorism, or is there also an eye to be placed on places where you've got long-term strongmen, presidents who've been ruling countries, much like the thugs for decades, but are not particularly motivated by religious sentiments?
Well, as I said, the CIA is interested in what's going on everywhere. Now, if you're asking me where the greatest dangers are, Al-Qaeda is a amorphous, loosely knit network of people that are sort of cheerleading each other on. And there are indigenous groups in various countries who have greater or lesser capability to get together, to organize, to get money, to do things, to recruit people, to build suicide vests and so forth. This is not sort of a command central type operation where we'll send you 20 suicide vests tomorrow. It's sort of you're on your own. Allah will be pleased if you will do this, you know, go create mayhem. But they do claim the identity. They do claim the association with a radical ideology. There are all kinds of surrogate activities going on, of annexes of Al-Qaeda, of alphabet soup of Al-Qaeda here and there. It's all over the cultural barrier lines of the old caliphate. If you follow the old caliphate that essentially goes from the Philippines all the way across the southern tier of Asia and into Africa, across northern Africa, not only the Maghreb in northern Africa, but down into the Sahel along the differences between the nomadic people. Those areas are ripe for trouble, and all of them are on the watch list. if you pick up a paper today, you will see there's trouble in Mali. Mali has been a very dependable ally for a long time. Things are suddenly going sideways in Mali.
And we see also political unrest in Senegal.
Absolutely. And Senegal is the opening to the sea, as we all know, for Mali. And the president there, who is an older gentleman, is being threatened. And there will be a change there, and that will change the dynamics. There are very few presidents there who have honored the term limitation. And in Mali, you see this happening. You saw that in Ghana, John Kufuor. These people need to be applauded. The problem is when these people leave after two terms, what comes in? And it goes to the very same problem we're looking at in the Arab Spring. It's fine to talk about regime change. The question of who decides there's going to be regime change, how you get regime change, what comes next, are all really the vital parts of that discussion. And if you don't have the answers to those questions, you probably shouldn't be talking publicly about regime change, unless you're talking about elections in the United States, because we do it right and peacefully.
I was going to say regime change is certainly something you've spoken about and advocated the American style of following democratic elections.
Of course.
But as we've seen in Iraq and also in Afghanistan, it can be very hard to implement that in cultures that are not really used to it.
Of course. I mean, this is an evolutionary process. Look at Latin America from 1950 to 2000, say. We used to have a lot of dictatorships in Latin America.
The banana republics.
The banana republics, the Somozas, and so forth. Many of them ended up being wonderful residents of the state of Florida. But the fact is that through the institution elements of civilization, the labor unions, the chambers of commerce, the business organizations, the campesino organizations, the university systems, the regular elements of an organized civilized society, even the political party system, eventually a form of democracy came, and there is a form of elections. Now, some are more free and more democratic than others, obviously. The same idea is going on around the world. What we are trying to espouse, without interfering or telling people how to do their business, is that an orderly transfer of power, a peaceful transfer of power, is a lot better. And part of that involves a loyal opposition as opposed to a disloyal opposition or a bunch of people who know that if they don't have power anymore, they're going to jail or they're going to be dead. And there's a lot of the world that hasn't evolved to that point yet that says, we are ready to trust that this change of power is going to work to our benefit or not work to our disadvantage.
Is that an America knows best attitude, though?
Not at all. Not at all. I think that people around the world, part of the human condition is wanting some degree of freedom, some degree of assembly. I don't think that the Arab Spring is a yearning for democracy outbreak at all, but I think it is a yearning for, I want something better than what I've got. This is a bad deal I've got here, and I want it changed. And so you see different people rioting together in Tahrir Square, and then you discover that when Mubarak is gone, they suddenly start fighting with each other because of who gets the pie now that Mubarak hasn't got it. So you've got suddenly this big question about what comes next. Now, then you start asking yourself, was Mubarak really that bad? Did he ever do anything good? Well, actually, he did. He did an awful lot for the economy of Egypt over the years. Not enough. And certainly there is plenty of unrest in Egypt. There's not enough jobs, a huge youthful population. The Brotherhood was not treated equally. There were human rights abuses and so forth. But Mubarak on the international stage provided some very helpful support for our Mideast policy, not our Mideast policy, a workable, peaceful Mideast policy that helped with the Israeli-Palestinian problem. So this is a good thing. Without Egypt, that wouldn't have happened. So maybe Mubarak wasn't really as bad as some people would like to have you believe. And what's coming after Mubarak possibly could be worse. We don't know what it's going
to
be.
Are you saying that, you know, sometimes it's okay to overlook what might be questionable actions in favor of stability?
What I'm saying is that it's an evolutionary process, and part of the process is understanding that you have to have some stability involved for the rest of the civilization, the civilizational aspects, to begin to formulate and grow and prosper. It would be wonderful if we could get rid of all the police forces and all the military because there was no crime and no combat and no problem. We made paradise. We're in nirvana. That's wonderful. It's just not the way it is in the world. So the question is, how do you have a benign stability force that still encourages and trusts the rest of the process to work. It's called loyal opposition. Can we have loyal opposition? And if we can have loyal opposition, then we can have peaceful elections.
My guest is Porter Goss. He's former director of the CIA, also served as a congressman from Southwest Florida, and interestingly was the first elected mayor of Sanibel Island over in Lee County as well. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM Orlando. I do want to ask you a little bit about your previous life in the CIA. You've been quoted in the Washington Post in 2002 about your early intelligence career in the 1960s as having had, quote, some small boat handling experience, some very interesting moments in the Florida Straits, and you said, quote, you don't think you'd be comfortable going to Cuba. Can you shed any light on this?
Well, one of the things we don't do, even though we're supposed to admit we never worked for CIA and taken an oath to that, when I ran for public office, I went back to CIA and I said, look, I've got to account for those 12 years somehow. What can I say? And they say, you can work. You can say you worked at CIA. You can't say what you did. And we'd prefer that you not get too specific about where you did it. I talk about the Cuban Missile Crisis because it was the most dangerous moment in my life. There's no doubt about it. That was the closest we came to nuclear war since I've been alive. There was one other instance that I'm very aware of where we had a technological glitch and the Russians felt that we might have launched and we weren't quite sure that they knew that it was a bad signal and so forth. That was scary, but we got the technology squared away and the back channels worked and everything worked and said, you know, forget the radar. It's not what it is. This was real. This was absolutely real. These were real bullets and real people and real bad things happening. We didn't know who was going to blink. And to the great credit of the United States of America, we stood very tall, and we called the Russians' bluff, and they turned the ships around at the very last second. I mean, there was no room left. We were at the clock was down. Our planes were just about to attack the Russian cargo ships with those containers with the missiles on them. There were missiles already in Cuba. They had already deployed them. They could have done huge devastation to the United States of America, not just Florida. Plus, we had all of our military down in South Florida, south of Miami. It was a very different time, and it was very scary. I was a young case officer, and my job, somebody looked at a Rolodex and understood that I had been a photo interpreter in the Army, so I got to see those photos and understood and was a believer. You could see the missile deployments on the ground. You could interpret what they were. It was a very big armed enemy 90 miles away from the coast of the United States of America. We wound that down successfully, and that was an extraordinary success story for the United States of America. My role in it, I'm not going to talk much about, but I'll stand by the statement. I did have some interesting time with small boat handling. It's one of the things I actually did know something about.
How was the CIA different when you worked there in the 60s and 70s compared to when you came in as the director?
In those days, clandestine was clandestine, and it meant it. And you did not, I mean, you stuck to your cover stories. People didn't know. I mean, a lot of my family had no idea what I did. It was a very different time, and it was just expected that these secrets would be kept forever, that we would do these things, and they would never come out. And that there was a certain community esprit. It wasn't a esprit de corps in the military sense, but there was a spree in the agency. I mean, we're doing very dangerous things in dangerous places. You're on your own a lot. You're trained to do all this stuff. It's lonely. There's a lot of sacrifice involved. It's just rugged on your family relationships. All of this was part of it and made you feel you were doing something wonderful for your country. That eroded very heavily after we started to have some defectors. Philip Agee was the first, and he started identifying case officers. That was just unthinkable. That was betrayal. It was treason. And I think he's in Cuba now today. I'm not sure if he's still alive. But I think he finally took refuge in Cuba. I mean, to me, he should have been tried and put in jail for forever. That started it. And then we had the Watergate issues and the question of trusting your government and surveillance and so forth started. Then the Church Commission. And that kept raising these questions about, let's analyze this question of clandestine service. Do we really want this? Do we really need this? And there's a large element of our population that believes that we don't need it and that we should get rid of it because it hurts us. It gives us a bad reputation around the world because we have a clandestine service. Apparently, those people don't really understand that so does everybody else. And they'll find out as much about us as they possibly can. They want to know our vulnerabilities very definitely. We have a wonderful back-channel arrangement with our allies. And it's good enough so that our enemies are worried about it, and they're trying to sabotage it all the time. Our best bet is clandestine service and secrecy. So our allies can count on us what we're doing and know for a certainty over a back-channel that they won't read about it in the paper, and that our enemies don't know what we're going to do and will be concerned and anxious all the time. Those days are gone because now people who disagree with policy leak to the media, and the media can be dreadfully irresponsible. And we've seen case after case where political correctness or bias in the media or disagreement with the policy and so forth have led to leakage by anonymous officials who are never identified but always have an axe to grind. And those people can do a lot of damage and have done a lot of damage. And in the follow-up of 9/11, I would say our three most important programs of providing information to the President of the United States and to the National Security Team for the United States and our military, three of our most important programs were seriously damaged, if not outright stopped, by leakage to the press.
Talk to me a little bit about local Florida politics. A lot of people might not know that after you retired from the CIA in the 1970s, you moved to Sanibel Island, and you actually helped to start the local newspaper, The Island Reporter, which is still going strong today. How'd you get involved with that?
Well, it's not going as strong as I'd like it to be, unfortunately. It just recently ceased being a newspaper of circulation of subscription, and so it's not doing the job that we originally hoped it would be, which would be the community newspaper for official notice and all things happening. And I don't know why that is. I've sort of lost track of that enterprise. We originally started it, and when I say we, it was a bunch of my former CIA friends who had retired from CIA. I was in Sanibel on a medical problem. We all got together and decided that doing nothing was not very satisfactory. Doing something would be fun. And we all cared very much about Sanibel. It's a beautiful place. It was threatened with a lot of growth. Some thought that might be good. And if it was the right kind of growth, it would be. And if it was the wrong kind of growth, it would end up trashing the place. And it's the natural resources on Sanibel should not be trashed. It's a wonderful family outdoor recreation tourist spot. It's just one of the assets of Florida, and I felt a stewardship responsibility. So these other folks, of course, there's an element of self-interest because we live there. We started a newspaper because we felt there needed to be a community voice, and we wanted something to do, and this seemed to be a responsible way to spend our day. And it was very successful. The circulation grew very quickly. It was a good newspaper. It turns out that the county of Lee was not very sympathetic to the people of Sanibel, and that sort of became our cause of trying to point out why the county was not really paying much attention to Sanibel. And when they were doing things that the people of Sanibel really didn't want. So one way or another, the newspaper sort of became the rallying point. Although we didn't take a pro or con position, we became the informative center of the issue of should Sanibel incorporate and take care of its own destiny, or do we trust the county commissioners in Lee County? Well, a vote came in at 58-42 or something, and we parted company with the county and set up our own city. And that was a wonderful, satisfactory experience of expression of democracy. And the first thing we did was nobody knew how to run a city. So, okay, let's go hire a bunch of people who know how to run a city. Who are the best people in the world on growth management and growth control and land use planning and that kind of stuff? We actually became a template. We did it right. We spent time. We spent money. We involved everybody on the island. Nobody got left out.
That can be tough when you're making decisions by a committee that big.
It was hugely tough. Everybody on the island was on a committee. I was the mayor, and I spent morning, noon, and night in committee meetings talking to people and getting input. The way we finally did it is we set up a comprehensive land use plan, and that became the focal point for all of the information.
Let me ask you, how do you feel, or how did you feel at that time, acting as a journalist with your background in intelligence? Did you find the two career paths divergent, or were there similarities there?
I obviously resigned immediately from the paper. Didn't want any conflict of interest. And even having had an association with the paper, there was an ethics complaint was filed by a disgruntled person in the city, which was a technical violation, which was changed because they changed the law. It was a, you know, not an event. But there were people watching. And part of the reason was there were actually some people who really believed that this was a CIA takeover of a small island off the coast of Florida. We used to laugh about it because the people on the paper, who are my friends, were all former CIA officers and all pretty much declared as such. And the one of the Washington papers came out with a story that said, what does CIA want with Sanibel, Florida? Why are they doing this? And somebody then pointed out, he said, well, they did the Bay of Pigs up there on the next island, the Yuseppa. That was a big training ground. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's it was sort of. So suddenly we had this sort of spirit, and everybody thought it was a tongue-in-cheek. What does CIA want? Not at all. A very important person, actually, a national security advisor to the White House, got up and said, you're defaming these people, and you're defaming Sanibel. And this has got nothing to do with CIA. This is just good community action. He took it totally seriously. So the story gained some legs and sort of become part of the legend now. The newspaper, perhaps we had the understanding about political action because of our jobs, but nothing was ever more transparent or more participatory than our experience on the newspaper, because everybody was bringing stuff in and asking for stuff to what they had to find out. And stuff. People were genuinely interested in trying to figure out what the future of Sanibel would be and what it would look like in 10 years or 20 years. And it was very successful. It's a great story.
You mentioned crafting that land use and growth management regulations for Sanibel. And of course, recently, the state of Florida has seen big transformation under Governor Rick Scott, where the Department of Community Affairs, which was the state's lead growth agency, has been eliminated. And now a lot of these powers have gone back to local communities to really and planning agencies to decide how best they should grow. And the question I think some people have wondered, is it going to be a race to the bottom in terms of who's going to really enforce strict growth management laws and who's going to maybe not, in order to allow growth and generate economic prosperity in their region? What do you think about that change that has gone on in the state since those times?
I guess the way I would respond to that is that all these mechanisms that are out there in these various layers of government that we have probably cause more consternation and mistrust in government than it's worth it for the regulation. If you're talking about enforcement, there are a couple of things that are pretty much reliable in our country. Not entirely, because we've had some very weird Supreme Court decisions. But generally, private property rights are respected in this country. That's one of the tenets of our founding fathers, is that private property is sacred and you're allowed to do with it what you want, as long as it fits into the community good, and the community has a pretty fair idea of what the community good is. And as long as the community good is reasonable and it's not trivial, you should go ahead and be able to do pretty much what you want. Now, I think the issue of community decision-making about its own future was resolved in about 1926 when we decided to have zoning boards. And if you've got a zoning board, you agree with the premise that, yes, you have private property rights, but they are subject to the zoning of our community, and the zoning is subject to the will of the people, which is done in open hearings and so forth. And if enough people want it to look this way, then that's the way it's going to look. And if enough people want it to be this way, then it's going to be that way. So as long as there are no surprises, it's done fairly, there are notifications, it's a free country, free assembly, freedom of speech, all of that comes into play. Your private property rights are preserved. You end up with a community that suits the majority of the people. Now, if you don't like it, you can leave. The question is, can you leave with your assets recovered when that happens? And that's a question that goes back to the private property rights. And the courts, unfortunately, have been a little erratic on that point. So I don't have an easy answer, but I can tell you we did not depend on the state of Florida They were neither an ally nor an opponent, really, of what we were doing. We pretty much worked with people who understood the substance of good land use management. And we went for substance in our plan of what a good plan would be, how it would hold up, and what our community would look like if we implemented that plan in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. And we are now out since 1974, that many years. It's, what, 35 years or so. We're very happy with our plan. The interesting thing about it is if we wanted to change, it only takes 3 votes of the city council.
I did want to ask you a little bit about keeping secrets. In your congressional career and certainly your intelligence career, you've had to keep a lot of secrets. And I just wonder, at a personal level, are you constantly having a dialogue in your mind saying, oh, wait, no, I can't talk about this, I can't talk about that, or is everything pretty compartmentalized? I just wonder, what's inside the mind of a former director of Central Intelligence to maintain those securities?
It is a constant test. I have sort of standard remarks I make. I do a lot of public speaking and some consulting. I am very, very careful to try and think who is the client. What is the purpose of this? What are we doing? Is there anything sinister involved here? Is there something I know that would be particularly important that I don't want to let slip out? Most of what I know is getting old fast. A lot has to do with personalities. A lot has to do with contacts, methods, and sources, and so forth. I would never talk about those. I've tried to put those out of my mind. I have extraordinarily deep information on a lot of very special capabilities we have I would never talk about. There are a few things occasionally you can get tripped up inadvertently. Somebody will come to you and say such and such and ask you a question, and you sort of think, oh, yeah, I remember that. And then suddenly you remember, oh, yeah, I'm not supposed to remember that. So those moments still do happen occasionally. But by and large, the idea of trying to honor the commitment I have to protect classified information means a great deal to me, and I stick with it very, very closely.
I have to ask this one for our listeners. As a former director of Central Intelligence, what is your favorite spy movie, and also what do you think is the most accurate portrayal of that world in a movie?
You know, I've never seen one that I think is a very accurate portrayal. I sort of liked the trilogy that's out there that's been running.
The Bourne movies?
Bourne Supremacy.
The Jason Bourne movies?
Yeah, the Jason Bournes. They're sort of fun to watch. You know, I sometimes wish we had capabilities like that. But some of those movies are very entertaining, and most of them are pretty far off the mark. There was a movie that was done that I think was Enemy of the State, it may have been the name of it, where they started the movie off by rolling the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, knocking him out, putting him in a car, and rolling him into a pond. And since that was my job at the time, I paid attention to the movie. It was about an NSA rogue operation. And I found that entertaining, and there's been a lot of concern about NSA and our privacy and our secrecy and so forth, and violates of our rights as Americans. I can't tell you how much time is spent making sure that our capabilities don't violate the rights of Americans, but it's very difficult.
Porter Goss is former director of the CIA from 2004 to 2006. Before that, he served in Congress and local Florida politics. Thank you so much for your time, sir.
Mark, my pleasure. It's been fun.
You can hear part one of my interview with former CIA Director Porter Goss online at WMFE.org/intersection. There you can also grab our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is the assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.